Tonight we are on concept 7, page C21 in the back of the 2021 through 2023 Red Service Manual, which reads, the conference recognizes that the charter and the bylaws of the General Service Board are legal instruments, that the trustees are thereby fully empowered to manage and conduct all of the World Service affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is further understood that the conference charter itself is not a legal document, that it relies instead upon the force of tradition and the power of the AA purse for its final effectiveness. And Billy, you'll have until 2 minutes to the top of the hours, and the time is now yours.
Thanks, Billy Alcoholic. Welcome, everyone. We are on page 21. I'm just going to read that again, just because for people who are new, there is some confusing language in there because of words that are used twice, but with different meaning. So the conference recognizes that the charter and bylaws of the General Service Board are legal instruments. That's the charter and the bylaws of the General Service Board. That the trustees are thereby fully empowered to manage and conduct all of the World Service affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is further understood that the conference charter itself, so another charter, the one for the General Service Conference, is not a legal document, that it relies instead on the force of tradition and the power of the AA purse for its final effectiveness. So I'm going to tell you that, like the word punitive, which it seems that we have all kinds of people now saying that if you remove somebody, it's punitive, which the service manual makes clear is not. There are quite a few groups, the last time I've checked in, that are using the power of the personnel. Whether they should or shouldn't is not my business. That is the business of that autonomous group vote. Do I have feelings about it? Sure. I think it should be the last thing that a group does. I think that you should write a letter before you do it and try to get a response. I think you should invite your area delegate to your group. And if your area delegate comes and refuses to answer questions or says, like, what is commonly becoming very common now, which is, if you ask questions, you're a troublemaker, then fine, do it. But if your area delegate shows up and is answering questions as honestly as they can, get all that information before you exercise the power of the purse. But I don't want to label any group that's exercising the power of the purse of being out of hand. I was recently listening to a regional trustee's report from 2 weeks ago, not in my region, from another region, at an event. And, you know, I found a couple of things interesting there. The regional trustee went on a real rant about politics in AA, and not outside politics, but inside AA politics. And the quote was, is that, you know, once the agenda comes out, the areas should be getting their information from their delegate. That's where they should get their information from. Anyone that knows me knows that if I'm doing a workshop during conference season, it's the first thing I always say. Don't ask questions about agenda topics because I'm not going to answer them. But I found that trustees comment that only the delegate should be supplying information interesting, because we all know that every weekend leading up to this last conference, trustees and chair people of conference committees were doing workshops that were pro plain language big book. Now, it doesn't matter if you're pro or con, but it seems to me that if we're going to start talking about the power of the purse and politics, that the rules should be for everyone. Is what I'm trying to say. The rules should apply to everyone. Now, this word, charter. So if you want to make a note, The archives in New York has not been able to locate the original charter of the General Service Board. It's one of those things that back in 1939, when the Alcoholic Foundation was formed, somehow slipped through the cracks. And the state of New York doesn't keep records going back that far, and things like that didn't make the microfilm. When they did use microfilm, now they use other digital methods. But what is fact is that charter in 1939 was a word for a description of the certificate of incorporation. So that's what they mean when they say the charter and bylaws. The certificate of incorporation and the bylaws of the General Service Board are legal instruments. Now, in the service manual, the bylaws of the General Service Board are there, and I would suggest reading them. The certificate of incorporation is not. I've asked Dee to put it in the files, but Dee, if you could bring it up for a second. So in 2006, we refiled a new certificate of incorporation. It's a very long, boring document if you want to go on and scroll, but I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But if you're interested, it's in the files. So you can take it down. I just wanted to let you know that if you're that into it, it'll be in the files. The trustees are thereby fully empowered to manage and conduct all of the World Service affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when it comes to us dealing with the outside world, we have to do certain things, even if people think they're not spiritual. But we have to fit in to the outside world to the extent we can collect money in our seventh tradition contributions, to the extent that we have bank accounts in New York that groups can send contributions in and we can put money into the bank, to the extent that we would, let's face it, we have almost a $20 million operation with assets in our pension fund and reserve fund over 50 million. And we sign contracts for huge amounts, like the stadium in Vancouver for 3 days, like the convention center in Vancouver for 4 days. We can't, anytime I hear somebody who gives an area or an intergroup a hard time for incorporating, there's a little known thing that we never talk about, but it's unfair to put AA trusted servants in that position. And that is, if you're asking them to put their personal assets on the line for any liability. If you are an area or an intergroup and you hold events and you rent space and you sign hotel contracts, should the officers of your area or intergroup be personally responsible? If anybody signs a contract, unless they sign it as a representative of a corporation or a partnership or an LLC, they're signing it as them, as an individual. And we can't expect people to do this. So, in order to function in the outside world, we need to have a legal entity. We have three corporations in New York: AA World Services, Inc., AA Grapevine, Inc., the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, Inc. We want to be a 501c3 corporation. That's the type of nonprofit that we are. There are other types. Some people don't realize that there are other types of nonprofit corporations. The NFL, believe it or not, is a nonprofit corporation. There are other types of nonprofit corporations. And when we talk about being a nonprofit corporation and managing and conducting the world affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous, nonprofit does not mean losing money. It also does not mean that we can't make any extra money. We probably should always err 5 to 10% safety. Nonprofit means no individual can receive a dividend or any piece of the profit. And we're allowed to use the word profit. I see people say that too. We're allowed to use the word profit. We just invest our profit back in our mission. That's what makes us a nonprofit. The other thing, and I just throw this out there because AAWS, AA Grapevine, and the General Service Board, they take a lot of heat, but I can tell you what they are good at: following the law, following the guidelines of the state they're incorporated in, which is in New York. Do you know how many AA service entities right now are out of compliance with their state? If I just, I don't even want to insult anyone by saying the number, but I will tell you it is a lot. I get calls every year from somebody who realizes, wow, Billy, we did not even pay our filing fee for this year. Or we didn't send in the minutes to our annual meeting. Or we didn't have an annual meeting. Like sometimes people think that we can just like get our nonprofit because it's two separate things. The 501c3 status comes from the federal government, but your incorporation papers come from the state you're incorporated in. And all those states have requirements. And if you've not heard this before, let me say it as simple in layperson's terms as I can say it. There is a requirement to being a nonprofit. You're making a commitment to the government that you're going to operate better than a for-profit industry. You are going to be more transparent and more accountable. And sometimes people think we're AA and we can do whatever we want. There are also some laws around there in the states that get us into a little trouble every once in a while, especially when it goes to do with stealing or embezzling money. If you are a nonprofit in many states, if an officer of the nonprofit embezzles money, you have an affirmative requirement to report it to your state's attorney general's office. They don't give you the option of saying, oh, no, we don't want to be punitive. No, you don't have that option. In the last 10 years, there have been two or 12 years, two area treasurers prosecuted, both one in a state, one in the District of Columbia, one in New Jersey. Both of those states, the district, not state, have requirements that if an officer embezzles money, it must be reported. And when it was reported, those authorities prosecuted those two area treasurers. So we like to throw out all these fancy spiritual terms and like we live better than everyone else, but I'm just letting everyone know that when we decide to operate as a legal entity in the outside world, we're agreeing to comply with all of their rules and their guidelines and their laws. And that's the reason we have a legal entity, or three of them, at the General Service Board level at AAWS and AA Grapevine, so that we can transact business in the outside world. So that we can have a lease, so that we can have a website, so that we can take contributions, so that we can take your credit card offered orders for literature, so that we have the assets in a bank that we can rent space. No one rents out a stadium, by the way, without asking for a little collateral. I mean, they don't say, oh, yeah, it's AA. We know you'll give it to us back in perfect shape. No, that doesn't happen. Sometimes we need what we call LOCs, letters of credit. So I just want to get that point across that we need this. On the first page, it says, on one hand, we see the Board of Trustees, which is invested with complete legal power over AA's funds and services. That's a strong statement. Complete legal power. There's no one above the trustees when it comes to any of the three corporations. The 21 trustees are the 21 owners of AA World Services, the 21 owners of the AA Grapevine, and the 21 owners of the General Service Board, Inc. So it says we see the Board of Trustees, which is invested with complete legal power over AA's funds and services. While on the other hand, we find that AA's General Service Conference is clothed with such great traditional influence and financial power that if necessary, it could overcome the legal rights of the Board of Trustees. It can therefore give the trustees directives and secure compliance with them, practically speaking. I know that we keep raising the individual rate of what you can contribute. And this year, we raised it to 7,500. 7,500. Now, mind you, if we normally take in about 11 million, 10 million and change of contributions and about 7 or 8 million in literature profit, 5 million, it seems right now we're a little down, but that means we would only need 1,466 people to give 7,500 out of 2 million. And 1,466 divided by 93, we would only need to find 15 people in each of the 93 areas to give 7,500. We keep lifting this number like it's going to somehow save us, but it is also going to have a drastic effect that the power of the purse could go away. If our focus is on individual contributions and not group contributions, it will not matter if groups don't give anymore. And the next paragraph says this means that the practical power of the conference will nearly always be superior to the legal power of the trustees. This superior power in the conference flows from the powerful tradition influence of the charter itself. It derives from the large majority of group chosen delegates in the conference. And finally, in any great extremity, it would rest upon the undoubtedly ability of the delegates to deny the General Service Board the monies which to operate vis-a-vis the voluntary contributions of the AA groups themselves. Theoretically, the conference is an advisory body only. And then here is the killer statement. But practically speaking, it has all of the ultimate powers and rights that it may ever need. Every single concept stresses that the spiritual power supersedes the legal. It says when we reflect that the trustees have no salaried financial interest in their posts, we can be quite sure that the board would never think of legally contesting the clear and sustained will of the conference delegates and the AA areas they represent. If someday the chips were really down, there would be little chance of a stalemate. The conference would find itself in complete control of the situation. As the conscience of AA, the delegates would find themselves in ultimate authority over our General Service Board and also its corporate arms of Active World Services. And why is he saying complete? He's saying complete because if something like that ever happened, we would be talking about the past activities of the board or the office. And concept four makes clear that trustees and service workers should not vote at the conference when it has to do with reports of their previous actions. So that's why he's stressing here that it's the area delegates that would be making that decision. There's a trade-off here, though. If I go to the next page on 22, the third paragraph, it says, it thus became obvious that new trustee choices subject to this conference approval will still have to be pretty much left to the trustees themselves. Only they would be capable of understanding what the board needed. Except in a time of reorganization, this method of selection would have to continue, certainly to as to the larger part of the board's membership. Otherwise, the board could not be held accountable for management results. We might wind up with no effective management at all. For these reasons, the conference was given the right to reject, but not elect, new trustee candidates. And this applies to all except, we're going to get a little complicated here. Spiritually, the conference elects regional trustees and trustees at large. That's 10, 10 of the 21. The area, I mean, the region delegates, plus members of the trustees nominating committee and the conference committee on trustees elect regional trustees. However, that's not a legal election. After the General Service Conference that Saturday at the board meeting, the board has the legal election. And the board just takes the names that won at conference and puts them on the slate and approves them. Then there's 11 other trustees, seven non-alcoholic and four alcoholic. They are basically chosen by the board. They are not elected at conference. They are approved at conference, but not elected at conference. This is what that paragraph is talking about, because when you look at these 11 people, the board knows what it needs. Does it need a finance person? Does it need a publisher? Does it need an IT person? Does it need an executive? Does it need an accountant? What skills do we need on the board right now? And this is where it's talking about that the trustees know what they need and where they're short. And none of this should interfere with the trustees and the directors of the corporation's right to run the businesses. I am not here, even though I am a big believer in the ultimate power of the conference. That should be used sparingly and not very often when it comes to the routine and ordinary business. That's what the boards are there for, to carry out that business. Now, one difference of opinion that I may have in current modern day AA compared to the AA service that I grew up in is the reason for our legal structure is to deal with the outside world, not the inside world. Last year, during, let's just call it the times of trouble, there were lots of different debates going back and forth about the issue with the chair resigning. And, just being fair, the trustees have a fiduciary duty to not do anything that would subject AA to being sued and putting their assets at risk. So, on that situation, the trustees were very careful about what information they released regarding how the chair left. However, some delegates seemed to be upset that lawyers for the General Service Board were actually drafting the communications to the delegates. I'm not sure it was ever supposed to go that far. I get we got to protect the GSB, AAWS, and AA Grapevine. And we got to make sure that we don't do anything that harms somebody's reputation that we would get sued. But Coca-Cola doesn't sue Coca-Cola, okay? There are no lawsuits, Coca-Cola versus Coca-Cola. And the trustees are part of the General Service Conference. The employees or the staff members are part of the General Service Conference. There should not be a war among those 135 people of us and them. They should be meeting as a body. If you go down two paragraphs more on page 22, the fifth paragraph, it says, up until the present time, which is 1961, our experience shows that this balance of power between the trustees and the conference is thoroughly workable. We have taken great pains to reserve final authority to the conference by practical and traditional means. By legal means, we have delegated ample functional and discretionary authority to the trustees. We believe this balance can be maintained indefinitely because the one is protected by tradition and the other by law. And I believe it can go on indefinitely. As someone who served as a trustee for 4 years and a director on AAWS for 8 years, I think the current structure is very workable if it's honored as to how it was meant to be worked. We cannot have the General Service Conference deciding what color the walls they want painted at the General Service Office or what health insurance company we should use for our employees or selecting which mutual or index funds we should invest the pension in. Those things are things that belong to the legal side of the house, to the trustees. And, when we get later into concepts 9 and concepts 11, I know I'm going to use a word that freaks people out. So brace yourself. But it says we should select the best possible leaders. The best. It does not say we have lifetime achievement awards that you did 30 years in service, so it's your turn to be a trustee. No, we don't have that. We have the Concept 9 leadership requirements, and out of that, we should select the best. If anything, I think we do a really good job of selecting people. What we do a bad job of is getting word out. We have 2 million AA members. How many know we're looking for a non-trustee director? We know how many people aren't connected to the service structure. And I'm dating myself now. But when I became a non-trustee director, and I became a general service trustee, there was hard paper copies of box 459. Do you know how many trustees, even non-alcoholic, I know that only became a trustee because they read an opening in box 459 in a meeting, or somebody read an opening in a meeting and gave it to their doctor or their bishop or their priest or a warden they knew? Like, the bad thing about electronic communication, and I'm a big believer in virtual and digital and electronic communication, but I do think it insulates us. It insulates us into only people that are involved in service. There's even a special note now on the non-trustee director app, notice that goes out telling past delegates, because it goes out to delegates, trustees, past trustees, current directors on AA and AA Grapevine, and intergroups, and current appointed committee members. That's who that notice goes out to. There's a special note that was added in 2012 because we found that some delegates were only sending it to past delegates. They didn't want anyone else to apply. So we had to make it clear that you don't have to be a past delegate to be a non-trustee director. By the way, little thing to put in the back of your head, you don't need to be a past delegate to be a regional trustee or a trustee at large. One of the areas in the Southeast region has nominated a DCM to be trustee at large. One of their past delegates stood for regional, but it's a DCM that's standing for a trustee at large. My point is that we know that we have best and brilliant people of all types, and some of them might not be involved in general service. We want to get those notices out to everybody. There is a part in concept 8 that comes into concept 7. I'll talk about it a lot next week, but when we get to concept 8, we will be talking about custodial oversight. And we define custodial oversight as electing the directors on AAWS and AA Grapevine. And we will go into great detail next week on that subject. But Concept 8 has an exception to custodial oversight, a carve out. And we'll go into detail next week on that carve out. It tells the General Service Board to stay out of the business of AAWS and AA Grapevine, except in two specific situations. If AA World Services and the AA Grapevine aren't playing well in the sandbox together, if they're not cooperating, it is the General Services Board job to step in. If AAWS or AA Grapevine is exceeding their budget, it is the job of the General Service Board to step in. Those are carved out in Concept 8, and I will get into it. And I say that because it's important to understand that the last paragraph on 22 says our trustees certainly do have this absolute legal authority, but there is nothing in their charter that compels them to use all of their authority all of the time. They are quite at liberty to accept advice or even direction from anyone at all. They can simply refrain from using their legal right to say no when it would be much wiser, all things considered, to say yes. Just as the conference should avoid the use of its traditional authority, so should the trustees avoid overuse of their legal rights. The president of the U.S., for example, has an absolute legal right to veto congressional legislation. Yet 99% of the time he does not do it because he likes a piece of literature or he does not like the legislation, but believes a veto would nevertheless be unwise or impossible of success. Whether or not he will exercise his veto is determined by circumstance. It's just like that with AA's Board of Trustees. Except, I'm not sure I like that example because we don't have an individual veto in AA. When we go on to page 23, where it says clearly, then our Board of Trustees does reserve a veto power over any conference action, that's the Board of Trustees acting with substantial unanimity, two-thirds vote. The chair of the General Service Board does not have veto power over the conference. In fact, if you are really into AA service, you would know that 4 years ago there was an incident at the conference. At that incident at the conference, the chair of the General Service Board, acting at that time as the chair of the General Service Conference, ruled a committee's report out of order, would not let them present it to the floor of the conference. When someone went to question it, the chair ruled the person out of order, giving themselves complete individual veto authority. If you were following that situation, you knew that the next year an agenda item was sent in to make clear that if someone at the conference does not agree with a decision made by the chair, that the person can ask for the conference body to vote on that decision of process and let the conference decide it. But we don't have individual vetoes. It goes on to say, this is legally necessary and right in principle, even though the veto will seldom be used. At certain times, however, the trustee's veto could be of important and constructive use. Here, for instance, are three typical examples in which it would be the duty of the trustees to veto conference action. Now, we like to say, and I think it's a fair, honest statement, that the trustees have never vetoed an advisory action of the conference and said, we're not doing this. And that's fair. And the three examples that it gives, it says, number one, in a time of heavy stress or haste, the conference should take any action or issue a directive to the trustees in clear violation of its own charter, or that the General Service Board, or if the conference were to pass any measure so ill-considered or so reckless as to seriously injure, in the judgment of the trustees, AA's public relations, or AA as a whole, it would then be the duty of the trustees to ask for a conference reconsideration. In the event of a conference refusal to reconsider, The trustees could then use their legal right of veto, and if desirable, they could appeal the issue directly to the AA groups themselves. We don't make good rush judgments as alcoholics. I think we all know that. The second example is, although traditionally the trustees have never substantially exceeded a conference-approved budget without consulting the conference, they should feel entirely free to reduce the conference budget figure during any fiscal year, even though such an action might curtail or cancel special plans or projects initiated and directed by the conference itself. I'm a little bit of a pet peeve person on this example because we can't find in our history, like, it's kind of gone down missing. The conference doesn't approve the budgets anymore. But yet it says right here, it says substantially exceed a conference approved budget. Now, what we could say is advisory actions have budgets now. When you submit a conference recommendation from a committee to the floor, you must have the financial impact on that. And then it says three, if by reason of unforeseen conditions, any particular plan, project, or directive of the conference should become impracticable or unworkable during a fiscal year, the trustees should, without prejudice, be able to use their right of veto and cancellation. It's the last one I want to talk about. Unforeseen conditions, any particular plan, project, or directive of the conference should become impractical or unworkable. We've never vetoed one of these, but if you look back at the history of conference, there's tons of times something is passed at the conference. And in the first two board weekends of the year after conference in January and October, the trustees committee or corporate board that's working on putting into place what the conference passed realizes, whoa, this isn't going to work. Or there might be too many unintended consequences that we never thought about. The trustees have never vetoed that, but what they have done is not put it into action before the next conference, and instead taking something from the trustees committee and sent it back to the conference committee the next year and said, hey, the conference told us to do this last year. We're working on it. But we need your feedback on this, this, and this because it's not really workable. So they're not vetoing it. They're just saying, we need to work on this a little more. We need some of your feedback because what you're asking us to do, probably one of the best examples of this, which by the way went back and forth like three conference cycles, is translating background material. Because that came out of nowhere. Translating the background material to French and Spanish came, I want to say, in 2015 or 16, out of the conference finance committee. That was because every year, staff and management was saying it would be too expensive to do. So the finance committee said, we don't care. We looked at the budget. Find the money. But that was a big undertaking. So that has gone back and forth to the conference committee a few times after that, because we do that. But it's a pretty strong statement that we just had our 74th General Service Conference. We're electing panel 75 delegates now. Is that what the conference has asked to do? We've done. Now, that was another interesting thing I heard 2 weeks ago and got lots of emails about. And I told you, like, I'm a freak when it comes to everything should be fair and equitable to all parties. So there was a lot of talk about politics and there were a lot of talk about floor actions. And should the board have to follow floor actions, you know? And are floor actions dangerous? And shouldn't we just accept the committee's recommendation? That sounds really good. Except for the fact it was a staff member who made the floor action for the preamble. So if you're going to get on a soapbox and you're going to start telling people that they can't make floor actions, particularly area delegates. Now, there were multiple floor actions made, by the way, on the preamble. Delegates, staff, but it has to be equal. The charter is so clear that all 135 people are equal voters. Nobody is in a special class. I myself might be willing to get rid of floor actions for everybody. There are other structures that don't follow our structure. In Costa Rica, at their General Service Conference, a committee's recommendation is binding unless the full conference body votes two-thirds to not follow it. So theirs is kind of opposite of ours. In ours, a committee recommendation has no power unless it's approved by two-thirds of the conference. In theirs, a committee recommendation is considered what we're doing unless two-thirds of the conference votes against it. All I'm saying is that whenever we run into trouble at the conference, it's always because we're interpreting different things for different situations for different types of voters instead of doing the same thing all the time. I am not one of these people who believe that the trustees do not need all this legal authority. They absolutely do need all this legal authority. And, we ask a lot of them, and I don't know who the trustee or past trustee would be that I've disagreed with the most, but I'll tell you one thing I can say. They've sacrificed a lot of their time for Alcoholics Anonymous. They've put a lot of mileage on their car, mileage in the air. They've taken many hours, not just board weekends, conference calls, Zoom meetings, everything. We can't ask people to dedicate that kind of time and not give them the legal power that they need to conduct business. It's just we have to remember, and we will talk about this next week with Concept 8, that the conference is supposed to stick to large matters of policy and finance. And the board is supposed to stay away from large matters of policy and finance. That belongs to the conference. And regular and usual business operations, the board, that's their business. And the conference should stay out of micromanaging that. And the whole secret is to kind of keep the pendulum in the middle and not swinging to too many sides. So I have a question. In your view, at group, district, or area level, if one person stands for a service position, a non-anonymous call is asked by the full body, is there any disapproval? Is that sufficient? If one or two may have an objection, it would be very rare for anyone to voice their concern. So here's what I think. There is a procedure in Robert's Rules of Order where a motion could be made. So let's say only one person stood and I'm at that assembly and I have a vote at that assembly. There are some areas, I haven't seen it in a long time, but they used to be very official about it, where someone would have to make a motion for the secretary to cast one ballot in favor of the one name who stood. That motion would have to be seconded, and then that person would need two-thirds of the voters present to be elected. The difficulty with one-person elections is that we try to not be personally punitive, and however, we do have areas that have gotten into trouble when nobody stood for a position, an officer position, and one person stood and they just said, okay, by acclamation, they get it. And they were not qualified to be a secretary or the treasurer. And we have had some disastrous results all over the US and Canada. It doesn't happen a lot, but every once in a while when it happens, I remember the last time I got called into a bad situation in the Northeast. And when the person was telling me on the phone, I said, how'd this person get elected? And they said, oh, no one else stood. They were the only one who stood. And so I'm not in favor of character assassinating people, but that's what I like about the motion to have the secretary cast one ballot that requires a second and then two-thirds vote, because then it's not personal. Then you're not talking bad about somebody. It's just up to the body whether they accept that person or not. But I do think it's something that, areas should be prepared for, because if the wrong person is elected to the wrong position, it can cause some problems. Do you know when it was decided and who decided that the conference no longer approves the budget? I don't. I have somebody else. I'm working on this project now to kind of find out. It looks like it was at one point, then it wasn't. But each committee does give a budget for the project. So that could be determined to be what's the conference approved budget, not the budget for the whole organization. But more to be reported on that. Any other questions? Yes, somebody just sent in the question. If the World Series is on next Monday night, will this meeting still go on? Of course. Of course. No doubt about Might I be in the parking lot? Yeah, that could be a good possibility too. But the meeting is still going on. Anyone else have any other questions? What about the motions to not consider floor actions? Any thoughts? Sure. I think it makes good sense. The rules were changed to make it very fair. Whoever makes the floor action, once it has to get a second. So you have 135 people there. Somebody has to second it. If it doesn't get a second, it's out. But once it's seconded, and this rule was changed in like 2012, and I think to make it fairer, the person who makes the floor action gets 2 minutes to explain their floor action or read it and explain it. It used to be that somebody could just get up right away and make a motion not to consider, but now the person making it gets their 2 minutes. Then a motion not to consider can be made. And then it's a vote of the conference floor. So I think the process is kind of fair. I don't think it's not like any 10 people could say we're not going to hear this. So I think the process is pretty fair. About what policies? Oh, my friend, one of my best friends who's the current regional trustee, he would love if I answered this question because he'd send me like a 10-page email. It says, about what policies or topics do you generally disagree with our current leadership? Yeah, I'm not answering that question. I could tell you that probably 95%, listen, they're making a big sacrifice and doing a great job on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I believe. Would I have issued a report saying that the word transparency does not exist in our service manual? No. I think that was a big mistake, and I think it caused some heartache. While the word transparency may be a current buzzword in the corporate world, our whole service manual talks about transparency without using the word. So, yeah, I've said before, I wish they would have written that better. But I don't have any disagreements with current leadership. And if I do, the place for me to take it is either to them directly, one-on-one, if I wanted to, or at my home group where my GSR gets to go to my assembly and let them know that, hey, if you could bring this up, I wish we could change it. Thoughts of power, the person, the individual member and group level, individual to group and group to service entities. Well, yeah. Listen, you have the power of the person, your group. If your group's not spending wisely or doing something, then I don't know why you would still be at that group, but yes, you could decide to hold back. Can you describe the difference between policy and procedure? Sure. Sometimes they're the same, but a policy is something put into place by group conscience. But you know what we're really bad at? We pass group consciences that create a procedure, but we don't write it down. Like, and the procedure should match the policy. The group conscience always prevails. Let's see. How could a floor action be called out of order? A floor action could be called out of order. That's not what I was talking about before. I was talking about a conference report that was called out of order, a committee's report. The most common reason, 99% of the time, in my experience, that a floor action is called out of order is there is a rule that a topic will only be considered once at the conference. So let me give you an example. If something doesn't come out of the committee, like the change to the preamble, it never left the committee and went to the conference floor. Because of that, it was eligible to be a floor action because the conference did not debate it already. Doesn't matter what that committee did. But if a committee sends something to the conference floor and the conference floor debates it and votes, that's it. Has minority opinion, has reconsideration, votes again, it's in the books. You don't get to bring that item to a floor action. That's 99% of the time when I've seen floor actions called out of order, it is because of that. I love when people write this. I did not say that if someone steals money, we must prosecute. Okay? I did not say that. What I said is if you are a nonprofit corporation, in many states, they have rules about officers of the legal entity embezzling money, you must report it. That's what I said. Other than that, it's a group conscience decision what you want to do. I read in July 1950 when they implemented a cap to individual contributions, the cap was determined by formula of 1/10 of 1% of the annual foundation budget. Is this still the formula used in determining the cap? No, it is not. Billy, number three on page C23, used when canceling the 2020 International Convention in Detroit. I'm curious if this is one of the unforeseen conditions. Not really, because the conference's role in selecting the location of the conference, of the International Convention, is to meet with the trustees committee and get it down to three cities. Once it's down to three cities, Then the trustees committee puts together a trip committee and visits those three cities, and the trustees decide the final selection. But the operation and running of it belongs to the trustees. That's why the trustees made that decision. First of all, the conference was virtual that year. No one expected that COVID was going to go to July. The trustees had enormous legal obligations to look at about if the convention still went on and people got sick or worse. That was a decision that squarely fell to the trustees. Okay, I'll answer this one and I'll be done. Since the delegates only served for 2 years, not all have prepared themselves with the last 4 years of advisory actions, which can sometimes make it difficult to understand why some delegates are asking for things that are no longer on the agenda. So I try to tell everyone I love the book, The Histories and Actions of the General Service Conference, but particularly for new delegates, I would not only want them to look at what their committee did the last 5 years, not even two or four, at least five. I would also want new delegates to look at the agendas of their committee for the last 5 years to see things that were on there but didn't make it to advisory action, so they have an idea about what was getting sent in. The advisory action, History and Actions, is probably one of the most underused books in all of AA. I was actually at an area assembly, I'm not going to say when, but a couple of years ago, I'm not going to say where. A couple of years ago, and the current delegate and the current area chair told me they had never seen that book before. Like, that book is gold when it comes to service. So the history and actions and the agendas for the committees and the advisory actions for the last 5 years. I actually think that for your committee, you should go back to the very beginning, 1951, and you should read all of the history and actions for your particular committee so that you have an idea of what the history is. That's it, Brooke. Thank you.
All audio and video files on the District6AA.org website or the District 6 in Area 15 YouTube channel are for personal use only. Reproduction, distribution, and commercial use are not permitted. In accordance with District 6 current practice, no faces are shown in our videos and audio is scrubbed for anonymity prior to publishing. Contributors whose voices are heard have given record and release consent. Opinions expressed by the presenter are their own and do not necessarily represent the group conscience of District 6 as a whole.